I shall say no more about them, as they came too late to influence philosophy. After these two men, though respectable work continued to be done in Alexandria, the great age was ended. Under the Roman domination, the Greeks lost the self-confidence that belongs to political liberty, and in losing it, acquired a paralyzing respect for their predecessors. The Roman soldier who killed Archimedes was a symbol of the death of original thought that Rome caused throughout the Hellenic world. Part 3. Ancient Philosophy After Aristotle. Chapter 25. The Hellenistic World. The history of the Greek-speaking world in antiquity may be divided into three periods. That of the free city-states, which was brought to an end by Philip and Alexander. That of the Macedonian domination, of which the last remnant was extinguished by the Roman annexation of Egypt after the death of Cleopatra, and finally that of the Roman Empire. Of these three periods, the first is characterized by freedom and disorder, the second by subjection and disorder, the third by subjection and order. The second of these periods is known as the Hellenistic Age. In science and mathematics, the work done during this period is the best ever achieved by the Greeks. In philosophy, it includes the foundation of the Epicurean and Stoic schools, and also of skepticism as a definitely formulated doctrine. It is therefore still important philosophically, though less so than the period of Plato and Aristotle. After the 3rd century BC, there is nothing really new in Greek philosophy until the Neoplatonists in the 3rd century AD. But meanwhile, the Roman world was being prepared for the victory of Christianity. The brief career of Alexander suddenly transformed the Greek world. In the 10 years from 334 to 324 BC, he conquered Asia Minor, Syria, Egypt, Babylonia, Persia, Samarkand, Bactria, and the Punjab. The Persian Empire, the greatest that the world had known, was destroyed by three battles. The ancient lore of the Babylonians, along with their ancient superstitions, became familiar to Greek curiosity. So did the Zoroastrian dualism, and, in a lesser degree, the religions of India, where Buddhism was moving toward supremacy. Wherever Alexander penetrated, even in the mountains of Afghanistan, on the banks of the Jaxartes, and on the tributaries of the Indus, he founded Greek cities, in which he tried to reproduce Greek institutions with a measure of self-government. Although his army was composed mainly of Macedonians, and although most European Greeks submitted to him unwillingly, he considered himself at first as the apostle of Hellenism. Gradually, however, as his conquests extended, he adopted the policy of promoting a friendly fusion between Greek and barbarian. For this he had various motives. On the one hand, it was obvious that his armies, which were not very large, could not permanently hold so vast an empire by force, but must, in the long run, depend upon conciliation of the conquered populations. On the other hand, the East was unaccustomed to any form of government except that of a divine king, a role which Alexander felt himself well fitted to perform. Whether he believed himself a god, or only took on the attributes of divinity from motives of policy, is a question for the psychologist, since the historical evidence is indecisive. In any case, he clearly enjoyed the adulation which he received in Egypt as successor of the pharaohs, and in Persia as the great king. His Macedonian captains, the companions as they were called, had towards him the attitude of Western nobles to their constitutional sovereign. They refused to prostrate themselves before him, they gave advice and criticism even at the risk of their lives, and at a crucial moment they controlled his actions, when they compelled him to turn homewards from the Indus instead of marching on to the conquest of the Ganges. Orientals were more accommodating, provided their religious prejudices were respected. This offered no difficulty to Alexander. It was only necessary to identify Ammon or Bel with Zeus and to declare himself the son of the god. Psychologists observed that Alexander hated Philip and was probably privy to his murder. He would have liked to believe that his mother, Olympias, like some lady of Greek mythology, had been beloved of a god. Alexander's career was so miraculous that he may well have thought a miraculous origin the best explanation of his prodigious success. The Greeks had a very strong feeling of superiority to the barbarians. Aristotle no doubt expresses the general view when he says that northern races are spirited, southern races civilized, but the Greeks alone are both spirited and civilized. Plato and Aristotle thought it wrong to make slaves of Greeks, but not of barbarians. Alexander, who was not quite a Greek, tried to break down this attitude of superiority. He himself married two barbarian princesses, and he compelled his leading Macedonians to marry Persian women of noble birth. His innumerable Greek cities, one would suppose, must have contained many more male than female colonists, and their men must therefore have followed his example in intermarrying with the women of the locality. The result of this policy was to bring into the minds of thoughtful men the conception of mankind as a whole. The old loyalty to the city-state, and in a lesser degree to the Greek race, seemed no longer adequate. In philosophy, this cosmopolitan point of view begins with the Stoics, but in practice it begins earlier, with Alexander. It had the result that the interaction of Greek and barbarian was reciprocal. The barbarians learnt something of Greek science, while the Greeks learnt much of barbarian superstition. Greek civilization, in covering a wider area, became less purely Greek. Greek civilization was essentially urban. There were, of course, many Greeks engaged in agriculture, but they contributed little to what was distinctive in Hellenic culture. From the Milesian school onwards, the Greeks who were eminent in science and philosophy and literature were associated with rich commercial cities, often surrounded by barbarian populations. This type of civilization was inaugurated not by the Greeks, but by the Phoenicians. Tyre and Sidon and Carthage depended on slaves for manual labor at home and on hired mercenaries in the conduct of their wars. They did not depend, as modern capital cities do, upon large rural populations of the same blood and with equal political rights. The nearest modern analogue is to be seen in the Far East during the latter half of the 19th century. Singapore and Hong Kong, Shanghai and the other treaty ports of China were little European islands where the white men formed a commercial aristocracy living on coolie labor. In North America, north of the Mason-Dixon line, since such labor was not available, white men were compelled to practice agriculture. For this reason, the hold of the white man on North America is secure, while his hold on the Far East has already been greatly diminished and may easily cease altogether. Much of his type of culture, especially industrialism, will, however, survive. This analogue will help us to understand the position of the Greeks in the eastern parts of Alexander's empire. The effect of Alexander on the imagination of Asia was great and lasting. The first Book of the Maccabees, written centuries after his death, opens with an account of his career. And it happened after that Alexander, son of Philip the Macedonian, who came out of the land of Ketium, had smitten Darius, king of the Persians and Medes, that he reigned in his stead the first over Greece, and made many wars, and won many strongholds, and slew the kings of the earth, and went through to the ends of the earth, and took spoils of many nations, insomuch that the earth was quiet before him. Whereupon he was exalted, and his heart was lifted up. And he gathered a mighty strong host, and ruled over countries and nations and kings, who became tributaries unto him. And after these things he fell sick, and perceived that he should die. Wherefore he called his servants, such as were honourable, and had been brought up with him from his youth, and parted his kingdom among them while he was yet alive. Footnote: this is not historically true. End of footnote. So Alexander reigned 12 years, and then died. He survived as a legendary hero in the Mohammedan religion, and to this day petty chieftains in the Himalayas claim to be descended from him. Footnote: perhaps this is no longer true, as the sons of those who held this belief have been educated at Eton. End of footnote. No other fully historical hero has ever furnished such a perfect opportunity for the mythopoeic faculty. At Alexander's death, there was an attempt to preserve the unity of his empire. But of his two sons, one was an infant and the other was not yet born. Each had supporters, but in the resultant civil war, both were thrust aside. In the end, his empire was divided between the families of three generals, of whom, roughly speaking, one obtained the European, one the African, and one the Asiatic part of Alexander's possessions. The European part fell ultimately to Antigonus's descendants. Ptolemy, who obtained Egypt, made Alexandria his capital. Seleucus, who obtained Asia after many wars, was too busy with campaigns to have a fixed capital, but in later times Antioch was the chief city of his dynasty. Both the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, as the dynasty of Seleucus was called, abandoned Alexander's attempts to produce a fusion of Greek and barbarian, and established military tyrannies, based at first upon their part of the Macedonian army strengthened with Greek mercenaries. The Ptolemies held Egypt fairly securely, but in Asia 2 centuries of confused dynastic wars were only ended by the Roman conquest. During these centuries, Persia was conquered by the Parthians, and the Bactrian Greeks were increasingly isolated. In the 2nd century BC, after which they rapidly declined, they had a king, Menander, whose Indian empire was very extensive. A couple of dialogues between him and Buddhist sage have survived in Pali and in part in a Chinese translation. Dr. Tan suggests that the first of these is based on a Greek original. The second, which ends with Menander abdicating and becoming a Buddhist saint, is certainly not. Buddhism at this time was a vigorous, proselytizing religion. Asoka, 264-28, the saintly Buddhist king, records in a still extant inscription that he sent missionaries to all the Macedonian kings. And this is the chiefest conquest in His Majesty's opinion, the conquest by the law. This also is that effected by His Majesty, both in his own dominions and in all the neighboring realms as far as 600 leagues. Even to where the Greek king Antiochus dwells, and beyond that Antiochus to where dwell the 4 kings, severally named Ptolemy, Antigonus, Megas, and Alexander. And likewise here, in the king's dominions, among the Yonas, that is, the Greeks of the Punjab. Unfortunately, no Western account of these missionaries has survived. Babylonia was much more profoundly influenced by Hellenism. As we have seen, the only ancient who followed Aristarchus of Samos in maintaining the Copernican system was Seleucus of Seleucia on the Tigris, who flourished about 150 BC. Tacitus tells us that in the 1st century AD, Seleucia had not lapsed into the barbarous usages of the Parthians, but still retained the institutions of Seleucus, its Greek founder. Footnote, the king, not the astronomer. End of footnote. 300 citizens, chosen for their wealth or wisdom, compose, as it were, a senate. The populace, too, have their share of power. Throughout Mesopotamia, as further west, Greek became the language of literature and culture, and remained so until the Mohammedan conquest. Syria, excluding Judea, became completely Hellenized in the cities, insofar as language and literature were concerned. But the rural populations, which were more conservative, retained the religions and the languages to which they were accustomed. In Asia Minor, the Greek cities of the coast had for centuries had an influence on their barbarian neighbors. This was intensified by the Macedonian conquest. The first conflict of Hellenism with the Jews is related in the books of the Maccabees. It is a profoundly interesting story, unlike anything else in the Macedonian Empire. I shall deal with it at a later stage, when I come to the origin and growth of Christianity. Elsewhere, Greek influence encountered no such stubborn opposition. From the point of view of Hellenistic culture, the most brilliant success of the 3rd century BC was the city of Alexandria. Egypt was less exposed to war than the European and Asiatic parts of the Macedonian domain, and Alexandria was in an extraordinarily favored position for commerce. The Ptolemies were patrons of learning and attracted to their capital many of the best men of the age. Mathematics became, and remained until the fall of Rome, mainly Alexandrian. Archimedes, it is true, was a Sicilian and belonged to the one part of the world where the Greek city-states, until the moment of his death in 212 BC, retained their independence. But he too had studied in Alexandria. Eratosthenes was chief librarian of the famous Library of Alexandria. The mathematicians and men of science connected, more or less closely, with Alexandria in the 3rd century before Christ were as able as any of the Greeks of the previous centuries and did work of equal importance. But they were not, like their predecessors, men who took all learning for their province. and propounded universal philosophies. They were specialists in the modern sense. Euclid, Aristarchus, Archimedes, and Apollonius were content to be mathematicians. In philosophy, they did not aspire to originality. Specialization characterized the age in all departments, not only in the world of learning. In the self-governing Greek cities of the 5th and 4th centuries, a capable man was assumed to be capable of everything. He would be, as occasion arose, a soldier, a politician, a lawgiver, or a philosopher. Socrates, though he disliked politics, could not avoid being mixed up with political disputes. In his youth, he was a soldier, and in spite of his disclaimer in the Apology, a student of physical science. Protagoras, when he could spare time from teaching skepticism to aristocratic youths in search of the latest thing, was drawing up a code of laws for Thurii. Plato dabbled in politics, though unsuccessfully. Xenophon, when he was neither writing about Socrates nor being a country gentleman, spent his spare time as a general. Pythagorean mathematicians attempted to acquire the government of cities. Everybody had to serve on juries and perform various other public duties. In the 3rd century, all this was changed. There continued, it is true, to be politics in the old city-states, but they had become parochial and unimportant, since Greece was at the mercy of Macedonian armies. The serious struggles for power were between Macedonian soldiers. They involved no question of principle, but merely the distribution of territory between rival adventurers. On administrative and technical matters, these more or less uneducated soldiers employed Greeks as experts. In Egypt, for example, excellent work was done in irrigation and drainage. There were soldiers, administrators, physicians, mathematicians, philosophers, but there was no one who was all these at once. The age was one in which a man who had money and no desire for power could enjoy a very pleasant life, always assuming that no marauding army happened to come his way. Learned men who found favor with some prince could enjoy a high degree of luxury, provided they were adroit flatterers and did not mind being the butt of ignorant royal witticisms. But there was no such thing as security. A palace revolution might displace the sycophantic sage's patron. The Galatians might destroy the rich man's villa. One city might be sacked as an incident in a dynastic war. In such circumstances, it is no wonder that people took to worshipping the goddess Fortune or Luck. There seemed nothing rational in the ordering of human affairs. Those who obstinately insisted upon finding rationality somewhere withdrew into themselves and decided, like Milton's Satan, that the mind is its own place and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. Except for adventurous self-seekers, there was no longer any incentive to take an interest in public affairs. After the brilliant episode of Alexander's conquests, the Hellenistic world was sinking into chaos, for lack of a despot strong enough to achieve stable supremacy, or a principle powerful enough to produce social cohesion. Greek intelligence, confronted with new political problems, showed complete incompetence. The Romans, no doubt, were stupid and brutal compared to the Greeks, but at least they created order. The old disorder of the days of freedom had been tolerable because every citizen had a share in it. But the new Macedonian disorder, imposed upon subjects by incompetent rulers, was utterly intolerable, far more so than the subsequent subjection to Rome. There was widespread social discontent and fear of revolution. The wages of free labor fell, presumably owing to the competition of Eastern slave labor, and meantime the prices of necessaries rose. One finds Alexander, at the outset of his enterprise, having time to make treaties designed to keep the poor in their place. In the treaties made in 335 between Alexander and the states of the League of Corinth, it was provided that the Council of the League and Alexander's representative were to see to it that in no city of the League should there be either confiscation of personal property, or division of land, or cancellation of debt, or liberation of slaves for the purpose of revolution. The temples in the Hellenistic world were the bankers. They owned the gold reserve and controlled credit. In the early 3rd century, the temple of Apollo at Delos made loans at 10%. Formerly, the rate of interest had been higher. Free labourers who found wages insufficient even for bare necessities must, if young and vigorous, have been able to obtain employment as mercenaries. The life of a mercenary, no doubt, was filled with hardships and dangers, but it also had great possibilities. There might be the loot of some rich eastern city. There might be a chance of lucrative mutiny. It must have been dangerous for a commander to attempt to disband his army, and this must have been one of the reasons why wars were almost continuous. The old civic spirit more or less survived in the old Greek cities, but not in the new cities founded by Alexander, not excepting Alexandria. In earlier times, a new city was always a colony, composed of emigrants from some one older city, and it remained connected with its parent by a bond of sentiment. This kind of sentiment had great longevity, as is shown, for example, by the diplomatic activities of Lampsacus on the Hellespont in the year 196 BC. This city was threatened with subjugation by the Seleucid king Antiochus III and decided to appeal to Rome for protection. An embassy was sent, but it did not go direct to Rome. It went first, in spite of the immense distance, to Marseille, which, like Lampsacus, was a colony of Phocea, and was, moreover, viewed with friendly eyes by the Romans. The citizens of Marseille, having listened to an oration by the envoy, at once decided to send a diplomatic mission of their own to Rome to support their sister city. The Gauls, who lived inland from Marseille, joined in with a letter to their kinsmen of Asia Minor, the Galatians, recommending Lampsacus to their friendship. Rome, naturally, was glad of a pretext for meddling in the affairs of Asia Minor, and by Rome's intervention, Lampsacus preserved its freedom until it became inconvenient to the Romans. In general, the rulers of Asia called themselves Philhellene and befriended the old Greek cities as far as policy and military necessity allowed. The cities desired and, when they could, claimed as a right democratic self-government, absence of tribute, and freedom from a royal garrison. It was worthwhile to conciliate them, because they were rich, they could supply mercenaries, and many of them had important harbours. But if they took the wrong side in a civil war, they exposed themselves to sheer conquest. On the whole, the Seleucids and the other dynasties which gradually grew up dealt tolerably with them, but there were exceptions. The new cities, though they had a measure of self-government, had not the same traditions as the older ones. Their citizens were not of homogeneous origin, but were from all parts of Greece. They were in the main adventurers, like the conquistadores or the settlers in Johannesburg, not pious pilgrims like the earlier Greek colonists or the New England pioneers. Consequently, no one of Alexander's cities formed a strong political unit. This was convenient from the standpoint of the king's government, but a weakness from the standpoint of the spread of Hellenism. The influence of non-Greek religion and superstition in the Hellenistic world was mainly, but not wholly, bad. This might not have been the case. Jews, Persians, and Buddhists all had religions that were very definitely superior to the popular Greek polytheism, and could even have been studied with profit by the best philosophers. Unfortunately, it was the Babylonians or Chaldeans who most impressed the imagination of the Greeks. There was, first of all, their fabulous antiquity. The priestly records went back for thousands of years, and professed to go back for thousands more. Then there was some genuine wisdom. The Babylonians could more or less predict eclipses long before the Greeks could. But these were merely causes of receptiveness. What was received was mainly astrology and magic. Astrology, says Professor Gilbert Murray, fell upon the Hellenistic mind as a new disease falls upon some remote island people. The tomb of Ozymandias, as described by Diodorus, was covered with astrological symbols. And that of Antiochus I, which has been discovered in Commagene, is of the same character. It was natural for monarchs to believe that the stars watched over them, but everyone was ready to receive the germ. It appears that astrology was first taught to the Greeks in the time of Alexander by a Chaldean named Berosus, who taught in Kos and, according to Seneca, interpreted Bel. This, says Professor Murray, must mean that he translated into Greek the Eye of Bel, a treatise in 70 tablets found in the library of Assurbanipal, 686 to 26 BC, but composed for Sargon I in the 3rd millennium BC. As we shall see, the majority even of the best philosophers fell in with the belief in astrology. It involved, since it thought the future predictable, a belief in necessity or fate, which could be set against the prevalent belief in fortune. No doubt most men believed in both and never noticed the inconsistency. The general confusion was bound to bring moral decay, even more than intellectual enfeeblement. Ages of prolonged uncertainty, while they are compatible with the highest degree of saintliness in a few, are inimical to the prosaic everyday virtues of respectable citizens. There seems no use in thrift when tomorrow all your savings may be dissipated. No advantage in honesty when the man towards whom you practice it is pretty sure to swindle you. No point in steadfast adherence to a cause when no cause is important or has a chance of stable victory. No argument in favor of truthfulness when only supple tergiversation makes the preservation of life and fortune possible. The man whose virtue has no source except a purely terrestrial prudence will in such a world become an adventurer if he has the courage, and if not, will seek obscurity as a timid time-server. Menander, who belongs to this age, says, "So many cases I have known of men who, though not naturally rogues, became so through misfortune by constraint." This sums up the moral character of the 3rd century BC, except for a few exceptional men. Even among these few, fear took the place of hope. The purpose of life was rather to escape misfortune than to achieve any positive good. Metaphysics sink into the background, and ethics, now individual, become of the first importance. Philosophy is no longer the pillar of fire going before a few intrepid seekers after truth. It is rather an ambulance following in the wake of the struggle for existence and picking up the weak and wounded. Footnote: C.F. Angus in Cambridge Ancient History, Volume 7, page 231. The above quotation from Menander is taken from the same chapter. End of footnote. Chapter 26. Cynics and Skeptics. The relation of intellectually eminent men to contemporary society has been very different in different ages. In some fortunate epochs, they have been on the whole in harmony with their surroundings, suggesting no doubt such reforms as seemed to them necessary, but fairly confident that their suggestions would be welcomed, and not disliking the world in which they found themselves, even if it remained unreformed. At other times, they have been revolutionary, considering that radical alterations were called for, but expecting that, partly as a result of their advocacy, these alterations would be brought about in the near future. At yet other times, they have despaired of the world, and felt that, though they themselves knew what was needed, there was no hope of its being brought about. This mood sinks easily into the deeper despair which regards life on earth as essentially bad, and hopes for good only in a future life or in some mystical transfiguration. In some ages, all these attitudes have been adopted by different men living at the same time. Consider, for example, the early 19th century. Goethe is comfortable. Bentham is a reformer. Shelley is a revolutionary, and Leopardi is a pessimist. But in most periods, there has been a prevailing tone among great writers. In England, they were comfortable under Elizabeth and in the 18th century. In France, they became revolutionary about 1750. In Germany, they have been nationalistic since 1813. During the period of ecclesiastical domination, from the 5th century to the 15th, there was a certain conflict between what was theoretically believed and what was actually felt. Theoretically, the world was a veil of tears, a preparation amid tribulation for the world to come. But in practice, the writers of books, being almost all clerics, could not help feeling exhilarated by the power of the church. They found opportunity for abundant activity of a sort that they believed to be useful. They had, therefore, the mentality of a governing class, not of men who feel themselves exiles in an alien world. This is part of the curious dualism that runs through the Middle Ages, owing to the fact that the church, though based on otherworldly beliefs, was the most important institution in the everyday world. The psychological preparation for the otherworldliness of Christianity begins in the Hellenistic period and is connected with the eclipse of the city-state. Down to Aristotle, Greek philosophers, though they might complain of this or that, were in the main not cosmically despairing, nor did they feel themselves politically impotent. They might at times belong to a beaten party, but if so, their defeat was due to the chances of conflict, not to any inevitable powerlessness of the wise. Even those who, like Pythagoras and Plato, in certain moods, condemned the world of appearance and sought escape in mysticism, had practical plans for turning the governing classes into saints and sages. When political power passed into the hands of the Macedonians, Greek philosophers, as was natural, turned aside from politics and devoted themselves more to the problem of individual virtue or salvation. They no longer asked, how can men create a good state? They asked instead, how can men be virtuous in a wicked world or happy in a world of suffering? The change, it is true, is only one of degree. Such questions had been asked before, and the later Stoics, for a time, again concerned themselves with politics, the politics of Rome, not of Greece. But the change was nonetheless real. Except to a limited extent during the Roman period in Stoicism, the outlook of those who thought and felt seriously became increasingly subjective and individualistic, until at last Christianity evolved a gospel of individual salvation which inspired missionary zeal and created the church. Until that happened, there was no institution to which the philosopher could give wholehearted adherence, and therefore there was no adequate outlet for his legitimate love of power. For this reason, the philosophers of the Hellenistic period are more limited as human beings than the men who lived while the city-state could still inspire allegiance. They still think, because they cannot help thinking, but they scarcely hope that their thought will bear fruit in the world of affairs. Four schools of philosophy were founded about the time of Alexander. The two most famous, the Stoics and Epicureans, will be the subjects of later chapters. In the present chapter, we shall be concerned with the Cynics and the Skeptics. The first of these schools is derived through its founder Diogenes, from Antisthenes, a disciple of Socrates, about 20 years older than Plato. Antisthenes was a remarkable character, in some ways rather like Tolstoy. Until after the death of Socrates, he lived in the aristocratic circle of his fellow disciples, and showed no sign of unorthodoxy. But something, whether the defeat of Athens or the death of Socrates, or a distaste for philosophic quibbling, caused him, when no longer young, to despise the things that he had formerly valued. He would have nothing but simple goodness. He associated with working men, and dressed as one of them. He took to open-air preaching in a style that the uneducated could understand. All refined philosophy he held to be worthless. What could be known by the plain man. He believed in the return to nature, and carried this belief very far. There was to be no government, no private property, no marriage, no established religion. His followers, if not he himself, condemned slavery. He was not exactly ascetic, but he despised luxury and all pursuit of artificial pleasures of the senses. "I had rather be mad than delighted," he said. The fame of Antisthenes was surpassed by that of his disciple Diogenes. A young man from Sinope on the Euxine, whom he, Antisthenes, did not take to at first sight, the son of a disreputable money-changer who had been sent to prison for defacing the coinage. Antisthenes ordered the lad away, but he paid no attention. He beat him with his stick, but he never moved. He wanted wisdom, and saw that Antisthenes had it to give. His aim in life was to do as his father had done, to deface the coinage, but on a much larger scale. He would deface all the coinage current in the world. Every conventional stamp was false. The men stamped as generals and kings, the things stamped as honor and wisdom and happiness and riches, all were base metal with lying superscription. He decided to live like a dog, and was therefore called a cynic, which means canine. He rejected all conventions, whether of religion, of manners, of dress, of housing, of food, or of decency. One is told that he lived in a tub, but Gilbert Murray assures us that this is a mistake. It was a large pitcher, of the sort used in primitive times for burials. He lived like an Indian fakir, by begging. He proclaimed his brotherhood, not only with the whole human race, but also with animals. He was a man about whom stories gathered, even in his lifetime. Everyone knows how Alexander visited him and asked if he desired any favor. "Only to stand out of my light," he replied. The teaching of Diogenes was by no means what we now call cynical. Quite the contrary. He had an ardent passion for virtue, in comparison with which he held worldly goods of no account. He sought virtue and moral freedom in liberation from desire. "Be indifferent to the goods that fortune has to bestow, and you will be emancipated from fear." In this respect, his doctrine, as we shall see, was taken up by the Stoics, but they did not follow him in rejecting the amenities of civilization. He considered that Prometheus was justly punished for bringing to man the arts that have produced the complication and artificiality of modern life. In this, he resembled the Taoists and Rousseau and Tolstoy, but was more consistent than they were. His doctrine, though he was a contemporary of Aristotle, belongs in its temper to the Hellenistic age. Aristotle is the last Greek philosopher who faces the world cheerfully. After him, all have, in one form or another, a philosophy of retreat. The world is bad. Let us learn to be independent of it. External goods are precarious. They are the gift of fortune, not the reward of our own efforts. Only subjective goods, virtue or contentment through resignation, are secure, and these alone, therefore, will be valued by the wise man. Diogenes personally was a man full of vigor, but his doctrine, like all those of the Hellenistic age, was one to appeal to weary men, in whom disappointment had destroyed natural zest. And it was certainly not a doctrine calculated to promote art or science or statesmanship or any useful activity except one of protest against powerful evil. It is interesting to observe what the Cynic teaching became when it was popularized. In the early part of the 3rd century BC, the Cynics were the fashion, especially in Alexandria. They published little sermons pointing out how easy it is to do without material possessions, how happy one can be on simple food, how warm one can keep in winter without expensive clothes, which might be true in Egypt, how silly it is to feel affection for one's native country or to mourn when one's children or friends die. "Because my son or my wife is dead," says Teles, who was one of these popularizing cynics, "is that any reason for my neglecting myself, who am still alive, and ceasing to look after my property?" At this point, it becomes difficult to feel any sympathy with the simple life, which has grown altogether too simple. One wonders who enjoyed these sermons. Was it the rich who wished to think the sufferings of the poor imaginary? Or was it the new poor who were trying to despise the successful businessman? Or was it sycophants who persuaded themselves that the charity they accepted was unimportant? Teles says to a rich man, "You give liberally, and I take valiantly from you, neither groveling nor demeaning myself basely nor grumbling." A very convenient doctrine. Popular cynicism did not teach abstinence from the good things of this world, but only a certain indifference to them. In the case of a borrower, this might take the form of minimizing the obligation to the lender. One can see how the word cynic acquired its everyday meaning. What was best in the Cynic doctrine passed over into Stoicism, which was an altogether more complete and rounded philosophy. Skepticism, as a doctrine of the schools, was first proclaimed by Pyrrho, who was in Alexander's army and campaigned with it as far as India. It seems that this gave him a sufficient taste of travel and that he spent the rest of his life in his native city Elis, where he died in 275 BC. There was not much that was new in his doctrine, beyond a certain systematizing and formalizing of older doubts. Skepticism with regard to the senses had troubled Greek philosophers from a very early stage. The only exceptions were those who, like Parmenides and Plato, denied the cognitive value of perception and made their denial into an opportunity for an intellectual dogmatism. The sophists, notably Protagoras and Gorgias, had been led, by the ambiguities and apparent contradictions of sense perception, to a subjectivism not unlike Hume's. Pyrrho seems, for he very wisely wrote no books, to have added moral and logical skepticism to skepticism as to the senses. He is said to have maintained that there could never be any rational ground for preferring one course of action to another. In practice, this meant that one conformed to the customs of whatever country one inhabited. A modern disciple would go to church on Sundays and perform the correct genuflections, but without any of the religious beliefs that are supposed to inspire these actions. Ancient skeptics went through the whole pagan ritual and were even sometimes priests. Their skepticism assured them that this behavior could not be proved wrong, and their common sense, which survived their philosophy, assured them that it was convenient. Skepticism naturally made an appeal to many unphilosophic minds. People observed the diversity of schools and the acerbity of their disputes, and decided that all alike were pretending to knowledge, which was in fact unattainable. Skepticism was a lazy man's consolation, since it showed the ignorant to be as wise as the reputed men of learning. To men who, by temperament, required a gospel, it might seem unsatisfying, but like every doctrine of the Hellenistic period, it recommended itself as an antidote to worry. Why trouble about the future? It is wholly uncertain. You may as well enjoy the present. What's to come is still unsure. For these reasons, skepticism enjoyed a considerable popular success. It should be observed that skepticism as a philosophy is not merely doubt, but what may be called dogmatic doubt. The man of science says, I think it is so-and-so, but I am not sure. The man of intellectual curiosity says, I don't know how it is, but I hope to find out. The philosophical skeptic says, nobody knows and nobody ever can know. It is this element of dogmatism that makes the system vulnerable. Skeptics, of course, deny that they assert the impossibility of knowledge dogmatically, but their denials are not very convincing. Pyrrho's disciple Timon, however, advanced some intellectual arguments which, from the standpoint of Greek logic, were very hard to answer. The only logic admitted by the Greeks was deductive, and all deduction had to start, like Euclid, from general principles regarded as self-evident. Timon denied the possibility of finding such principles. Everything, therefore, will have to be proved by means of something else, and all argument will either be circular or an endless chain hanging from nothing. In either case, nothing can be proved. This argument, as we can see, cut at the root of the Aristotelian philosophy which dominated the Middle Ages. Some forms of skepticism, which in our own day are advocated by men who are by no means wholly skeptical, had not occurred to the skeptics of antiquity. They did not doubt phenomena or question propositions which, in their opinion, only expressed what we know directly concerning phenomena. Most of Timon's work is lost, but two surviving fragments will illustrate this point. One says, the phenomena is always valid. The other says, that honey is sweet, I refuse to assert. That it appears sweet, I fully grant. A modern skeptic would point out that the phenomenon merely occurs and is not either valid or invalid. What is valid or invalid must be a statement, and no statement can be so closely linked to the phenomenon as to be incapable of falsehood. For the same reason, he would say that the statement, honey appears sweet, is only highly probable, not absolutely certain. In some respects, the doctrine of Timon was very similar to that of Hume. He maintained that something which had never been observed, atoms, for instance, could not be validly inferred. But when two phenomena had been frequently observed together, one could be inferred from the other. Timon lived at Athens throughout the later years of his long life, and died there in 235 BC. With his death, the school of Pyrrho as a school came to an end. But his doctrines, somewhat modified, were taken up, strange as it may seem, by the Academy, which represented the Platonic tradition. The man who effected this surprising philosophic revolution was Arcesilaus, a contemporary of Timon, who died as an old man about 240 BC. What most men have taken from Plato is belief in a supersensible intellectual world and in the superiority of the immortal soul to the mortal body. But Plato was many-sided, and in some respects could be regarded as teaching skepticism. The Platonic Socrates professes to know nothing. We naturally treat this as irony, but it could be taken seriously. Many of the dialogues reach no positive conclusion and aim at leaving the reader in a state of doubt. Some, the latter half of the Parmenides, for instance, might seem to have no purpose except to show that either side of any question can be maintained with equal plausibility. The Platonic dialectic could be treated as an end, rather than a means, and if so treated, it lent itself admirably to the advocacy of scepticism. This seems to have been the way in which Arcesilaus interpreted the man whom he still professed to follow. He had decapitated Plato, but at any rate the torso that remained was genuine. The manner in which Arcesilaus taught would have had much to commend it if the young men who learnt from him had been able to avoid being paralysed by it. He maintained no thesis, but would refute any thesis set up by a pupil. Sometimes he would himself advance two contradictory propositions on successive occasions, showing how to argue convincingly in favour of either. A pupil sufficiently vigorous to rebel might have learnt dexterity and the avoidance of fallacies. In fact, none seem to have learnt anything except cleverness and indifference to truth. So great was the influence of Arcesilaus that the Academy remained sceptical for about 200 years. In the middle of this sceptical period, an amusing incident occurred. Carneades, a worthy successor of Arcesilaus as head of the Academy, was one of three philosophers sent by Athens on a diplomatic mission to Rome in the year 156 BC. He saw no reason why his ambassadorial dignity should interfere with the main chance, so he announced a course of lectures in Rome. The young men, who at the time were anxious to ape Greek manners and acquired Greek culture, flocked to hear him. His first lecture expounded the views of Aristotle and Plato on justice, and was thoroughly edifying. His second, however, was concerned in refuting all that he had said in his first, not with a view to establishing opposite conclusions, but merely to show that every conclusion is unwarranted. Plato's Socrates had argued that to inflict injustice was a greater evil to the perpetrator than to suffer it. Carneades, in his second lecture, treated this contention with scorn. Great states, he pointed out, had become great by unjust aggressions against their weaker neighbours. In Rome this could not well be denied. In a shipwreck you may save your life at the expense of someone weaker, and you are a fool if you do not. Women and children first, he seems to think, is not a maxim that leads to personal survival. What would you do if you were flying from a victorious enemy, you had lost your horse, but you found a wounded comrade on a horse? If you were sensible, you would drag him off and seize his horse, whatever justice might ordain. All this not very
blunt stroke
argumentation is surprising in a nominal follower of Plato, but it seems to have pleased the modern-minded Roman youths. There was one man whom it did not please, and that was the elder Cato, who represented the stern, stiff, stupid, and brutal moral code by means of which Rome had defeated Carthage. From youth to old age he lived simply, rose early, practiced severe manual labour, ate only coarse food, and never wore a gown that cost over 100 pence. Towards the state he was scrupulously honest, avoiding all bribery and plunder. He exacted of other Romans all the virtues that he practised himself, and asserted that to accuse and pursue the wicked was the best thing an honest man could do. He enforced, as far as he could, the old Roman severity of manners. Cato put out of the Senate also one Manilius, who was in great towardness to have been made consul the next year following, only because he kissed his wife too lovingly in the daytime and before his daughter. And reproving him for it, he told him his wife never kissed him but when it thundered. When he was in power, he put down luxury and feasting. He made his wife suckle not only her own children, but also those of his slaves, in order that, having been nourished by the same milk, they might love his children. When his slaves were too old to work, he sold them remorselessly. He insisted that his slaves should always be either working or sleeping. He encouraged his slaves to quarrel with each other, for he could not abide that they should be friends. When a slave had committed a grave fault, he would call in his other slaves and induce them to condemn the delinquent to death. He would then carry out the sentence with his own hands, in the presence of the survivors. The contrast between Cato and Carneades was very complete. The one brutal through a morality that was too strict and too traditional, the other ignoble through a morality that was too lax and too much infected with the social dissolution of the Hellenistic world. Marcus Cato, even from the beginning that young men began to study the Greek tongue, and that it grew in estimation in Rome, did dislike of it, fearing lest the youth of Rome that were desirous of learning and eloquence would utterly give over the honour and glory of arms. So he openly found fault one day in the Senate, that the ambassadors were long there and had no dispatch, considering also they were cunning men and could easily persuade what they would. And if there were no other respect, this only might persuade them to determine some answer for them and to send them home again to their schools to teach their children of Greece and to let alone the children of Rome, that they might learn to obey the laws in the Senate as they had done before. Now he spake thus to the Senate, not of any private ill will or malice he bare to Carneades, as some men thought, but because he generally hated philosophy. The Athenians, in Cato's view, were a lesser breed without the law. It did not matter if they were degraded by the shallow sophistics of intellectuals, but the Roman youth must be kept puritanical, imperialistic, ruthless, and stupid. He failed, however. Later Romans, while retaining many of his vices, adopted those of Carneades also. The next head of the academy, after Carneades, circa 180 to circa 110 BC, was a Carthaginian whose real name was Hasdrubal, but who, in his dealings with Greeks, preferred to call himself Clitomachus. Unlike Carneades, who confined himself to lecturing, Clitomachus wrote over 400 books, some of them in the Phoenician language. His principles appear to have been the same as those of Carneades. In some respects, they were useful. These two skeptics set themselves against the belief in divination, magic, and astrology, which was becoming more and more widespread. They also developed a constructive doctrine concerning degrees of probability. Although we can never be justified in feeling certainty, some things are more likely to be true than others. Probability should be our guide in practice, since it is reasonable to act on the most probable of possible hypotheses. This view is one with which the most modern philosophers would agree. Unfortunately, the books setting it forth are lost, and it is difficult to reconstruct the doctrine from the hints that remain. After Clitomachus, the academy ceased to be skeptical, and from the time of Antiochus, who died in 69 BC, its doctrines became, for centuries, practically indistinguishable from those of the Stoics. Skepticism, however, did not disappear. It was revived by the Cretan Anisodemus, who came from Knossos, where, for aught we know, there may have been skeptics 2,000 years earlier, entertaining dissolute courtiers with doubts as to the divinity of the mistress of animals. The date of Anisodemus is uncertain. He threw over the doctrines on probability advocated by Carneades and reverted to the earliest forms of skepticism. His influence was considerable. He was followed by the poet Lucian in the 2nd century AD, and also slightly later by Sextus Empiricus, the only skeptic philosopher of antiquity whose works survive. There is, for example, a short treatise, Arguments Against Belief in a God, translated by Edwin Bevan in his Later Greek Religion, pages 52 to 56, and said by him to be probably taken by Sextus Empiricus from Carneades, as reported by Clitomachus. This treatise begins by explaining that, in behavior, the skeptics are orthodox. We skeptics follow in practice the way of the world, but without holding any opinion about it. We speak of the gods as existing and offer worship to the gods and say that they exercise providence. But in saying this, we express no belief and avoid the rashness of the dogmatizers. He then argues that people differ as to the nature of God. For instance, some think him corporeal, some incorporeal. Since we have no experience of him, we cannot know his attributes. The existence of God is not self-evident, and therefore needs proof. There is a somewhat confused argument to show that no such proof is possible. He next takes up the problem of evil, and concludes with the words, "Those who affirm positively that God exists cannot avoid falling into an impiety. For if they say that God controls everything, they make him the author of evil things. If, on the other hand, they say that he controls some things only, or that he controls nothing, they are compelled to make God either grudging or impotent, and to do that is quite obviously an impiety." Skepticism, while it continued to appeal to some cultivated individuals until somewhere in the 3rd century AD, was contrary to the temper of the age, which was turning more and more to dogmatic religion and doctrines of salvation. Skepticism had enough force to make educated men dissatisfied with the state religions, but it had nothing positive, even in the purely intellectual sphere, to offer in their place. From the Renaissance onwards, theological skepticism has been supplemented, in most of its advocates, by an enthusiastic belief in science. But in antiquity, there was no such supplement to doubt. Without answering the arguments of the skeptics, the ancient world turned aside from them. The Olympians being discredited, the way was left clear for an invasion of Oriental religions, which competed for the favor of the superstitious until the triumph of Christianity. Chapter 27. The Epicureans. The two great new schools of the Hellenistic period, the Stoics and Epicureans, were contemporaneous in their foundation. Their founders, Zeno and Epicurus, were born at about the same time, and settled in Athens as heads of their respective sects within a few years of each other. It is therefore a matter of taste which to consider first. I shall begin with the Epicureans because their doctrines were fixed once for all by their founder, whereas Stoicism had a long development, extending as far as the emperor Marcus Aurelius, who died in AD 180. The main authority for the life of Epicurus is Diogenes Laertius, who lived in the 3rd century AD. There are, however, two difficulties. First, Diogenes Laertius is himself ready to accept legends of little or no historical value. Second, part of his life consists in reporting the scandalous accusations brought against Epicurus by the Stoics. And it is not always clear whether he is asserting something himself or merely mentioning a libel. The scandals invented by the Stoics are facts about them, to be remembered when their lofty morality is praised, but they are not facts about Epicurus. For instance, there was a legend that his mother was a quack priestess, as to which Diogenes says, "They, apparently the Stoics, say that he used to go round from house to house with his mother, reading out the purification prayers, and assisted his father in elementary teaching for a miserable pittance." On this, Bailey comments, "If there is any truth in the story that he went about with his mother as an acolyte, reciting the formulae of her incantations, he may well have been inspired in quite early years with a hatred of superstition, which was afterwards so prominent a feature in his teaching." This theory is attractive, but in view of the extreme unscrupulousness of later antiquity in inventing a scandal, I do not think it can be accepted as having any foundation. Footnote: the Stoics were very unjust to Epicurus. Epictetus, for example, addressing him, says, "This is the life of which you pronounce yourself worthy, eating, drinking, copulation, evacuation, and snoring." Book 2, Chapter 20, Discourses of Epictetus. End of footnote. There is against it the fact that he had an unusually strong affection for his mother. The main facts of the life of Epicurus seem, however, fairly certain. His father was a poor Athenian colonist in Samos. Epicurus was born in 342 to 1 BC, but whether in Samos or in Attica is not known. In any case, his boyhood was passed in Samos. He states that he took to the study of philosophy at the age of 14. At the age of 18, about the time of Alexander's death, he went to Athens, apparently to establish his citizenship. But while he was there, the Athenian colonists were turned out of Samos, 322 BC. The family of Epicurus became refugees in Asia Minor, where he rejoined them. At Tars, either at this time or perhaps earlier, he was taught philosophy by a certain Nausiphanes, apparently a follower of Democritus. Although his mature philosophy owes more to Democritus than to any other philosopher, he never expressed anything but contempt for Nausiphanes, whom he alluded to as the mollusk. In the year 311, he founded his school, which was first in Mytilene, then in Lampsacus, and from 307 onwards in Athens, where he died in 270 to 1 BC. After the hard years of his youth, his life in Athens was placid, and was only troubled by his ill health. He had a house and a garden, apparently separate from the house, and it was in the garden that he taught. His three brothers and some others had been members of his school from the first. But in Athens his community was increased, not only by philosophic disciples, but by friends and their children, slaves and hetairai. These last were made an occasion of scandal by his enemies, but apparently quite unjustly. He had a very exceptional capacity for purely human friendship, and wrote pleasant letters to the young children of members of the community. He did not practice that dignity and reserve in the expression of the emotions that was expected of ancient philosophers. His letters are amazingly natural and unaffected. The life of the community was very simple, partly on principle and partly, no doubt, for lack of money. Their food and drink was mainly bread and water, which Epicurus found quite satisfying. "I am thrilled with pleasures in the body," he says, "when I live on bread and water, and I spit on luxurious pleasures, not for their own sake, but because of the inconveniences that follow them." The community depended financially, at least in part, on voluntary contributions. "Send me some preserved cheese," he writes, "that when I like I may have a feast." To another friend, "Send us offerings for the sustenance of our holy body on behalf of yourself and your children." And again, "The only contribution I require is that which blank ordered the disciples to send me, even if they be among the Hyperboreans. I wish to receive from each of you 220 drachmae a year and no more." Footnote, about $20. End of footnote. Epicurus suffered all his life from bad health, but learnt to endure it with great fortitude. It was he, not a Stoic, who first maintained that a man could be happy on the rack. Two letters written, one a few days before his death, the other on the day of his death, show that he had some right to this opinion. The first says, "7 days before writing this, the stoppage became complete, and I suffered pains such as bring men to their last day. If anything happens to me, do you look after the children of Metrodorus for 4 or 5 years, but do not spend any more on them than you now spend on me." The second says, "On this truly happy day of my life, as I am at the point of death, I write this to you. The diseases in my bladder and stomach are pursuing their course, lacking nothing of their usual severity. But against all this is the joy in my heart at the recollection of my conversations with you. Do you, as I might expect from your devotion from boyhood to me and to philosophy, take good care of the children of Metrodorus." Metrodorus, who had been one of his first disciples, was dead. Epicurus provided for his children in his will. Although Epicurus was gentle and kindly towards most people, a different side of his character appeared in his relations to philosophers, especially those to whom he might be considered indebted. "I suppose," he says, "that these grumblers will believe me to be a disciple of the mollusk, Nausiphanes, and to have listened to his teaching in company with a few bibulous youths. For indeed the fellow was a bad man, and his habits such as could never lead to wisdom." He never acknowledged the extent of his indebtedness to Democritus, and as for Leucippus, he asserted that there was no such philosopher, meaning, no doubt, not that there was no such man, but that the man was not a philosopher. Diogenes Laertius gives a whole list of abusive epithets that he is supposed to have applied to the most eminent of his predecessors. With this lack of generosity towards other philosophers goes another grave fault, that of dictatorial dogmatism. His followers had to learn a kind of creed embodying his doctrines, which they were not allowed to question. To the end, none of them added or modified anything. When Lucretius, 200 years later, turned the philosophy of Epicurus into poetry, he added, so far as can be judged, nothing theoretical to the master's teaching. Wherever comparison is possible, Lucretius is found to agree closely with the original, and it is generally held that elsewhere he may be used to fill in the gaps in our knowledge caused by the loss of all of Epicurus's 300 books. Of his writings, nothing remains except a few letters, some fragments, and a statement of principal doctrines. The philosophy of Epicurus, like all those of his age, with the partial exception of skepticism, was primarily designed to secure tranquility. He considered pleasure to be the good, and adhered with remarkable consistency to all the consequences of this view. "Pleasure," he said, "is the beginning and end of the blessed life." Diogenes Laertius quotes him as saying in a book on the end of life, "I know not how I can conceive the good, if I withdraw the pleasures of taste, and withdraw the pleasures of love, and those of hearing and sight." Again, "The beginning and the root of all good is the pleasure of the stomach. Even wisdom and culture must be referred to this." The pleasure of the mind, we are told, is the contemplation of pleasures of the body. Its only advantage over bodily pleasures is that we can learn to contemplate pleasure rather than pain, and thus have more control over mental than over physical pleasures. Virtue, unless it means prudence in the pursuit of pleasure, is an empty name. Justice, for example, consists in so acting as not to have occasion to fear other men's resentment, a view which leads to a doctrine of the origin of society not unlike the theory of the social contract. Epicurus disagrees with some of his hedonist predecessors in distinguishing between active and passive pleasures, or dynamic and static pleasures. Dynamic pleasures consist in the attainment of a desired end, the previous desire having been accompanied by pain. Static pleasures consist in a state of equilibrium, which results from the existence of the kind of state of affairs that would be desired if it were absent. I think one may say that the satisfying of hunger, while it is in progress, is a dynamic pleasure, but the state of quiescence which supervenes when hunger is completely satisfied is a static pleasure. Of these two kinds, Epicurus holds it more prudent to pursue the second, since it is unalloyed and does not depend upon the existence of pain as a stimulus to desire. When the body is in a state of equilibrium, there is no pain. We should therefore aim at equilibrium and the quiet pleasures rather than at more violent joys. Epicurus, it seems, would wish, if it were possible, to be always in the state of having eaten moderately, never in that of voracious desire to eat. He is thus led, in practice, to regarding absence of pain rather than presence of pleasure as the wise man's goal. Footnote. For Epicurus, absence of pain is in itself pleasure, indeed, in his ultimate analysis, the truest pleasure. End of footnote. The stomach may be at the root of things, but the pains of stomachache outweigh the pleasures of gluttony. Accordingly, Epicurus lived on bread, with a little cheese on feast days. Such desires as those for wealth and honour are futile, because they make a man restless when he might be contented. The greatest good of all is prudence. It is a more precious thing even than philosophy. Philosophy, as he understood it, was a practical system designed to secure a happy life. It required only common sense, not logic or mathematics or any of the elaborate training prescribed by Plato. He urges his young disciple and friend Pythocles to flee from every form of culture. It was a natural consequence of his principles that he advised abstinence from public life. For in proportion as a man achieves power, he increases the number of those who envy him, and therefore wish to do him injury. Even if he escapes outward misfortune, peace of mind is impossible in such a situation. The wise man will try to live unnoticed, so as to have no enemies. Sexual love, as one of the most dynamic of pleasures, naturally comes under the ban. Sexual intercourse, the philosopher declares, has never done a man good, and he is lucky if it has not harmed him. He was fond of children, other people's, but for the gratification of this taste, he seems to have relied upon other people not to follow his advice. He seems, in fact, to have liked children against his better judgment, for he considered marriage and children a distraction from more serious pursuits. Lucretius, who follows him in denouncing love, sees no harm in sexual intercourse, provided it is divorced from passion. The safest of social pleasures, in the opinion of Epicurus, is friendship. Epicurus, like Bentham, is a man who considers that all men, at all times, pursue only their own pleasure, sometimes wisely, sometimes unwisely. But again, like Bentham, he is constantly seduced by his own kindly and affectionate nature into admirable behaviour, from which, on his own theories, he ought to have refrained. He obviously liked his friends without regard to what he got out of them, but he persuaded himself that he was as selfish as his philosophy held all men to be. According to Cicero, he held that friendship cannot be divorced from pleasure, and for that reason must be cultivated, because without it neither can we live in safety and without fear, nor even pleasantly. Occasionally, however, he forgets his theories more or less. All friendship is desirable in itself, he says, adding, though it starts from the need of help. Epicurus though his ethics seemed to others swinish and lacking in moral exaltation, was very much in earnest. As we have seen, he speaks of the community in the garden as our holy body. He wrote a book on holiness. He had all the fervor of a religious reformer. He must have had a strong emotion of pity for the sufferings of mankind, and an unshakable conviction that they would be greatly lessened if men would adopt his philosophy. It was a valetudinarian's philosophy, designed to suit a world in which adventurous happiness had become scarcely possible. Eat little for fear of indigestion. Drink little for fear of next morning. Eschew politics and love and all violently passionate activities. Do not give hostages to fortune by marrying and having children. In your mental life, teach yourself to contemplate pleasures rather than pains. Physical pain is certainly a great evil, but if severe, it is brief, and if prolonged, it can be endured by means of mental discipline and the habit of thinking of happy things in spite of it. Above all, live so as to avoid fear. It was through the problem of avoiding fear that Epicurus was led into theoretical philosophy. He held that two of the greatest sources of fear were religion and the dread of death, which were connected, since religion encouraged the view that the dead are unhappy. He therefore sought a metaphysic which would prove that the gods do not interfere in human affairs, and that the soul perishes with the body. Most modern people think of religion as a consolation, but to Epicurus it was the opposite. Supernatural interference with the course of nature seemed to him a source of terror, and immortality fatal to the hope of release from pain. Accordingly, he constructed an elaborate doctrine designed to cure men of the beliefs that inspire fear. Epicurus was a materialist, but not a determinist. He followed Democritus in believing that the world consists of atoms and the void. But he did not believe, as Democritus did, that the atoms are at all times completely controlled by natural laws.